That's Freddie Hubbard taking the lead on trumpet in this number by Paul Chambers, bassist out of Detroit. You know, we have to have everything working here and dovetailing very nicely. So Paul Chambers assembled this quartet with a bunch of really good sidemen, Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Cannonball Adderley on alto sax, Wynton Kelly from my neck of the woods, Jamaica, actually. Well, Caribbean, I allow Jamaica. The perfect people are from Trinidad, but we'll take Jamaica on piano, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. I'm Eutrice Lead, and this is Lead Stories. It is Monday, December the 9th, and in South Africa, both houses of Parliament are recalled from recess today for a special session to honor the late President Nelson Mandela. Four U.S. presidents, Presidents Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, will be among some 50 world leaders attending a memorial service in Johannesburg tomorrow. President Jacob Zuma declared a 10-day period of mourning following Mandela's death last Thursday and culminating in a state funeral for Mandela, of course, who will be buried in his childhood village of Kunu on Sunday, December the 15th. And with only 2 weeks left before its legislative session ends for the year, Senate Democrats are trying to push past Republican stalling tactics on confirming five executive branch and judicial nominees. They include Attorney Cornelia Nina Pillard, whose appointment is being voted on today, and U.S. District Judge Robert Wilkins for the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, Janet Yellen to lead the Federal Reserve, Jay Johnson to head the Department of Homeland Security, and Representative Mel Watt of North Carolina to lead the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Both the House and Senate are also expected to work on a budget to allow to avoid another shutdown on January 15th. And other major legislation as well, including the controversial farm bill facing a $40 billion cut to the food stamp program and a proposal to cut Medicare physicians' payments by some 24%. In our ongoing series, we've been talking about various aspects of Detroit and its fiscal troubles, which on December the 3rd became the largest bankruptcy filing by a municipality in the history of the United States. Today, another aspect of the situation presented to us by our guest, a native Detroiter. He is Dr. Lester K. Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, whose areas of study include black politics, racial politics, urban politics, public opinion, and American political thought, and particularly intraracial inequality and resistance to it in the wake of what he calls the neoliberal turn. Dr. Spence has been published in both academic and mainstream journals and can regularly be heard on National Public Radio and the Mark Steiner Show. His book recently published, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, received the National Conference of Black Political Scientists, WEB, Distinguished Book Award. A previous book also has been jarring many, called We Are Many, Reflections on Movement Strategy from Occupation to Liberation. And I am so delighted that you can join us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, the way we would do this is just to give you, not to interrupt the flow, just keep quiet and you take us through your presentation, at the end of which, we say about 30 minutes or so, 30, 35 minutes, we'll open up for questions. All right.
Okay. So, 35 minutes on the radio. I can roll with that. So,
take as much time as you can.
No, I got you. I can do this. So, when we think about Detroit, so when your introduction, you talked about my interest in the neoliberal turn, and I'm just going to work on the assumption most of your listeners probably understand what I mean when I talk about the neoliberal term, but I got some of my boys and some of my girls, you know, dialing in, you know, so to explain it to them, you know, so when I go home, they won't have to ask me, what does this neoliberal term thing mean? This is what was what I mean. Around 1970 or so, you have among the West, you have this economic depression and the likes of which they really hadn't seen in 30, 40 years. And all the ideas and theories they had about economics itself, couldn't use those theories or those explanations to get themselves out of the problem, because you had high levels of inflation and high levels of unemployment happening at the same time. And those are two phenomenon that, according to the theories, the common sense of that time, those two things were never or very, very rarely supposed to happen at the same time. So because their theories didn't work, and those theories, the common sense theories of the time, allowed for a large welfare state, right? So even in a country like the United States, which is more conservative than its European counterparts, you had unemployment taken care of, you had public housing, you had welfare. For example, if you were a single mother with children, you had, you know, food stamps and the like, and you had a social safety net, right? So, in the once that crisis occurred, and when the economy, when people realized that what they needed was kind of a new economic theory, a set of economic theorists and business interests got together and proposed a new set of economic ideas, which basically eviscerated the welfare state, right? Which basically argued that the best way to deal with poverty is to incentivize people to work. The best way to deal with public goods like housing or education would be to privatize them. The best way for cities to grow was to increasingly become entrepreneurial, right? And the end result of that move, which begins in 1970s, intellectually speaking, but then policy-wise, we start to see this stuff roll out in the mid-70s, definitely by the election of Ronald Reagan, and then through Bush, through Clinton, through the next Bush, and through Obama. And what's happened as a result is we've seen inequality levels grow to the highest levels since they've been recorded. I believe levels of inequality are now greater than they've been at any time in the last 100 years, including the Great Depression. So what does that mean for – we're talking about Detroit. What does that mean for cities like Detroit, right? When you're talking about basically Rust Belt cities with high levels of with high population, high poor populations, and also high non-white populations. Cities, because cities were expected to become entrepreneurial, what cities like Detroit that were industrialized, deindustrialized, had to do was try to find something to replace all the jobs in the populations that left, right? And they consistently were made to do so by a combination of state decisions and federal decisions, right? So there was one time back in the day where cities could get a significant number of resources in the form of revenue sharing from the state government and from the federal government. But in order to incentivize entrepreneurial behavior at the city level, the federal government and the state government reduced that, right? So a city like Detroit, which was draining populations, which has lost approximately 1.1 million people from its height, right, is increasingly expected to become entrepreneurial, and it simply cannot do so, right? And to the extent that it does do so through tax abatements and the like, they're never able to get those tax abatement deals are never able to replace and grow the revenue they've lost, right? So in order to further incentivize cities, the state of Michigan created kind of an emergency financial manager law, which basically took away the city's ability to govern themselves if certain economic criteria were met, if the debt burden grew to a certain level. So over the past few years, almost every city with a majority black population has had some element of its governance or taken away from it, either public schools or the city government itself. So as I'm thinking, so that's kind of a long, that's a longish way to explain what I mean by the neoliberal turn, what the effects of it are. But the one thing I think I haven't talked about is the role that race plays, right? So if you think about all the various policies and ideas associated with neoliberalism and the neoliberal turn, what you see is that in all of them, the end result is that people without resources are have a smaller share of resources, so the percentage of the resources that they have, the amount of resources they have, decrease, right? Talk about that wealth inequality. And increasingly, they are punished for not having resources, right? So neoliberalism creates a condition in which there are clear winners and there are clear losers. Given that most Americans actually end up suffering as a result of neoliberal policies and neoliberal ideas, one question would be, okay, why do people take this? Why do people accept this? Their material interest, it would be in their material interest, you think, to actually support another type of policy arrangement, right? To actually have, at the very least, a moderate welfare state like the United States used to have. At most, a far more progressive welfare state like a number of European nations have. What is it that explains their lack of support, right? And this is where race does work, where once you have a dynamic in which the people who are tagged as losers and the cities that are tagged as losers are rendered non-normal, or once they're rendered non-normal, because in this case of their race, it becomes very, very easy for Americans in general to say, okay, they deserve what they get because they are not only are they not like me, that is, not only are they non-normal, they are actually culturally predisposed to being unable to function in the modern economy and in the modern political system. They're unable to govern themselves, they're unable to handle their finances, and that explains simultaneously the increased desire to deal with the poor and unemployed, to make them find work instead of giving them resources. And it also explains the visceral way in which the city of Detroit's been treated, both within the state of Michigan and also in the national government in general, right? So if you think about the narrative, why Detroit is like it is, why Detroit's failed, most people point to corruption. Most people point to the lack of the government, the lack of political officials' ability to make the hard choices, right? So somebody like Kwame Kilpatrick, who is the mayor in the early years of the 21st century and has been was recently sentenced to 23 years because of corruption, he becomes the poster child, not just for Detroit, but for other cities like it. Right. So that's kind of what I've been going for about 15 minutes. That's kind of the quick and dirty story about the neoliberal turn, about what its effects are, and then where Detroit stands in relation to that, how Detroit actually ends up being punished as a result of that. There's more, but
I don't want you to rush. I mean, really, please take your time, because if it needs to go to another day, we'll do that. But don't rush it. This is really important.
So this is what I want you to do. I want you to, so you ask me questions, right? So, cause it's all common sense to me, but it's likely that there are some aspects of the story, even in the 15 minutes I've talked about, that I need to expand more. So what is it, when you hear that story, what questions jump out at you?
Well, this the issue of race coinciding with President yeah. Obama echoing almost exactly the words of Nelson Mandela, talking about this, the state of affairs is that we have the greatest inequality that we've had for a very long time. But this is a manufactured inequality, because the stories we are hearing at ground level from Detroiters is that the city was also, even now, the situation isn't nearly as bad as people say it is. And that Detroiters have great faith in their city. They always have had a great love for the city. And they have the capacity. Of course, we're going to get corruption everywhere. I mean, we've had corruption at every single level of government. So it is not surprising that you would find an errant mayor, you know, a greedy mayor, somebody who decides to be corrupt. But we are hearing the flip side of the story from Detroiters, that this city is being used as a template to be, you know, to reproduce in other cities. And you've touched on that point, that we have now a confluence of race and class.
Yes. Yeah, okay, so this is what I'll do. So I'll come back to Obama in the end, right? But I'm realizing as you're talking that there's something that's important to discuss when we talk about, so for example, I didn't unpack what deindustrialization meant for Detroit.
Go ahead and unpack, my friend, because we'll take as long as it takes for you to get the story told. We need instruction, and we're in class.
I got you. So when I talk about deindustrialization, what I basically refer to is a dynamic by which the manufacturing sector, in Detroit's specific case, the automotive sector, leaves Detroit. They take their plants, and with it, they take hundreds and thousands of jobs, right? And they first flee Detroit for the South in the American case, and then they flee the states for foreign places, because their labor costs are smaller and their benefit, you know, they can basically work their employees like dogs without having to give them high wages or good benefits, right? And then with that, also large swaths of the population ends up fleeing. Now it's important to note again that the population of Detroit at its height was 1.8 million. But that's like in the 40s or early 50s, like maybe 1952. As early as 1950, as the 50s, populations started to flee Detroit for the suburbs. That fleeing is racially marked. It's the result of racist public policy. At the national level, the GI Bill had passed in order to give World War II veterans, in order to kind of pay World War II veterans for their service. It gave them access to cheap education. It gave them access to new housing. Now, that dynamic, those benefits are kind of racially, they're inequitably distributed racially. That is, that if you look at the resources blacks get, whites get, versus the resources that blacks get from that policy, whites get far more. So in housing, how this plays out is that the housing they get, the new housing they get, it has to be built in the suburbs, right? It cannot be built within the cities. And the suburbs, even in a northern state like Michigan, are racially segregated, right? So what you get is you give whites a resource, access to housing in suburban Detroit that only they can take advantage of. So as a result of deindustrialization, the jobs move out of Detroit, the population moves out of Detroit, but the population is largely white. There are suburbs that dot Detroit, even in 2013, that are, say, 85 to 90% white. You know, a city like Livonia, a city like Dearborn, a number of other cities like them are majority white, and that's basically it was basically a federal form of white affirmative action, or a federal, I don't like to use the term in that way, but it's shorthand. That is, a federal policy gave resources to whites that were withheld from blacks. All right, so when I talk about deindustrialization and the role race plays, that's what I'm talking about. So what you have left in Detroit, and that generates not only kind of a racially tinged wealth redistribution, it also generates racial antagonism between white suburbs and increasingly black Detroit. Antagonism that made metropolitan solutions to many of Detroit's problems very, 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 very difficult, if not impossible, to generate. Right? Now I'm going to talk about Obama's an interesting case, because when one of the consequences of this neoliberal turn is that you consistently see the federal government bend over backwards to give resources to capital, to manufacturing capital in the 70s, and then manufacturing capital and finance capital now, at the expense of giving resources to citizens. So if you remember in 2008 when the economy hit, Ford and GM, I think by that time Chrysler was owned by foreign interests. But Ford and GM go under. Obama gives a speech and says explicitly, we will not let Detroit go bankrupt. Now, what he meant at that time was not the city, was not the citizens. He was using Detroit as shorthand to refer to both Ford and General Motors. And they actually propped up Ford and General Motors to the point that they were that they became profitable. But he never made the same statement about Detroit and its residents, right? So now he's articulating this argument that inequality is really, really high and we have to deal with it. But what that translates to for cities like Detroit is not necessarily clear, because he stated that as Detroit was about to go bankrupt, the city itself, he stated that he was going to do nothing. Now, granted, in his context, he's constrained legislatively, because there's no way the House of Representatives, as is currently constituted, would support that. But Obama could, by rhetoric at least, give people on the ground the rhetorical resources they need to fight this, right? So that's one way to think about Obama's turn towards inequality. Now, going back to Kwame Kilpatrick for a second, I know that Kwame Kilpatrick was sentenced to he was sentenced to 28 years, but I think he has to serve at least 23 of that for a variety of corruption charges. It's important to note for the listeners that Kwame Kilpatrick, at the most, Kwame Kilpatrick, if he stole like much more than he was accused of stealing, he stole maybe somewhere around several million dollars from Detroit's budget. And it's important to note for the listeners also, I agree with his sentence, and I agree that he should serve that time, even though, you know, Detroit's a really, really small city. And I know Kwame, and my dad actually grew up with his parents. But even given that, I believe he should serve his time. But when you look at Detroit's state of affairs, the one thing that Kwame Kilpatrick did, which is arguably tied to Detroit's current issues, is in around 2004, 2005, he signed a deal with the bond rating agents that was a really, really complicated deal that basically gave Detroit capital in exchange for having to adhere to a set of really rigid and almost impossible economic guidelines. And basically that deal stated that if Detroit came near or close to bankruptcy, Detroit would have to pay the banks hundreds of million dollars in extra interest and hundreds of million dollars as like a penalty. Now, what's interesting about that dynamic, right? What's interesting about that deal is that all of the major newspapers of Detroit at the time, were the two major newspapers, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, supported that deal, right? Now, thinking also about Detroit's financial issues, about Detroit's inability to pay some of its bills, over the past several years, Detroit has given $290 million in taxes to building a stadium for the Detroit Red Wings. I'm a Detroit Red Wings fan. I have been for the last 30 or 40 years, but it's important to note that the Detroit Red Wings fan base, that is the people who go to Detroit Red Wings games, are 85, if not 90% white. They've given approximately $160 million in tax abatements to the building of Comerica Park, which houses the Detroit Tigers, and they've given $150 million to Ford Field, and that's the stadium that houses the Detroit Lions. And there is – Detroit still has a Renaissance Zone, which basically gives businesses in those zones the ability to forego paying city income taxes and a number of other taxes, right? So you think about, I talked about the neoliberal turn, and I talked about how it forces cities to become entrepreneurial. You can think about these various practices as practices which makes it far harder for Detroit to provide for its needs than if we had another set of tax policies. And when people are writing about it, when people are talking about Detroit, when people are talking about how Detroit got to where it's gotten, very few people on the left have, and Demos has released a report a couple of weeks ago that traces all this stuff, but the mainstream media has largely ignored these economic factors. And this makes it very difficult for people on the ground to fully understand what's going on. And it makes it far easier for a rollout like this to happen in other cities. You talked about Detroit being a template. It's clear exactly how Detroit's going to deal with this bankruptcy, a number of cities will largely follow suit, particularly if it means that they don't have to pay their pension responsibilities, they don't have to take care of their obligations to their citizens, who put their time in building the city, who put their time in making these cities the home for certain types of capital, and are now retired, should theoretically be able to have the just retire in the good night, knowing their needs are going to be met, but it's not clear that's going to do so. So, wow, I think I did that in about 30 minutes. I hope it made sense. Made sense to me.
Tell you what we do. We take a little break to give you a chance to just drink some water or something and come back to questions for our guest, Dr. Lester K. Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. 888-874-4888, and we come back right after these messages about other programs right here at PRN.FM. Listening to a little bit of Cannonball Adderley on this particular tune called I Heard That. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and we're talking in our ongoing series about Detroit. Our guest is Dr. Lester K. Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. I guess I could start off by asking, what, if anything, do you see as a silver lining, even now that Detroit is facing a rather really rough situation?
So real quick, before that's a great question. I've been on like Facebook, taking comments, you know, on or reading comments on Facebook. One thing that I misspoke on, and thank you to Carmel Knox, who's been a long-time friend and is a business owner in Detroit. He corrected me. GM and Chrysler actually took the bailout from the government. It was Ford that did not. So I talked about the big three, and when we talk about the big three in Detroit terms, we're talking about General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. General Motors and Chrysler took the offer to bail out. Chrysler didn't. That's just a correction. But as far as the silver lining, there is what I didn't talk about was that Detroit recently had an election in which you had an African-American who'd run for office times before and lost, running against a white county political official who had run for office, I think, in Detroit for the first time. And that white official actually won, making him the first white mayor Detroit's had in 40 years. And there's been a lot of discussion about that. I can deal with that in question and answers, but the one dynamic that people aren't talking about that is a silver lining that's part of that election is that Detroit, for the first time in a long while, has moved from citywide elections at the city council level to district elections at the city council level. So before this election, when you cast a vote in Detroit for the city council person, you voted for a slate of like nine, I think it was. And all nine of those people, rather than being connected to a specific neighborhood, represented the city at large. And that made it very difficult, if not impossible, to actually hold these individuals accountable, much less to use them as a check against the mayor, right? So what electing, what moving to districts enables us to do, well, first, it enables populations who hadn't had representatives to get representatives, right? So Detroit, even though Detroit is still like about 80-85% black, it still has a large Latino population, a growing Middle Eastern population, right? So for the first time, we now have a Latina elected on the city council. So we have people who are able to get representatives who before that weren't necessarily able to get representation. So that's generally. But more important for those of us on the left end of the political spectrum, it's now possible, it's now even more possible to use city council as a lever against the mayor. So one of the dynamics that's happened as a result of the neoliberal turn is that city after city after city after city have basically elected neoliberal mayors. That is, mayors who really, really believe in the market, mayors who really don't, who haven't even talked out loud about inequality, right? So somebody like de Blasio in New York is an outlier. So given this dynamic, what matters is that we find some lever to use against the mayor. Even in cities with black populations, this is as important with cities with non-black populations. The city council can actually serve as a lever in this case, particularly if you have a dynamic where you have district elections as opposed to at-large elections. So progressive forces can identify a couple of districts at a time and then use those individuals to either serve as a check to the mayor or potentially to run for mayor like later on down the road. So if you think about somebody like Chokwe Lumumba, who's the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, I believe, and who is a card-carrying black revolutionary, he comes to that office through serving terms at the city council. So that's one silver lining that deals with the election. The other silver lining is that for the first time, people are aggressively starting to talk about what a city should look like and what types of responsibilities that a city should what's a city's responsibility to its citizens? And these are conversations that we haven't had since the neoliberal turn in some way, since 1970, since 1980. So that's another silver lining. And then finally, we actually have people organizing on the ground in Detroit, and they're getting far more resources. At the very least, they're getting far more eyes on the work they do than they did previously when the neoliberal turn was still working on cities like Detroit, still working on city residents, but it was very hard to get rhetorical pushback. It's very hard to for people who are doing work on the ground to actually have eyes looking at them saying, okay, that there is an alternative there.
Well, we have Tom from Connecticut. Thank you, Tom, for calling.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
In a general sense, I mean, Detroit is a symptom of the gutting out of industrial cities across the United States over the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. How do we return? See, essentially, in my estimation, the golden age of essentially high-paid, low-skilled labor is gone. The things that supported my hometown area in southern New York State, which was shoe manufacturing, machine tool manufacturing, somebody with less than a high school degree or high school education or could get a job that could support a family. In a general sense, how can we rely on any private interests whose mandates are to keep labor costs as low as possible, to deny mm-hmm. benefits, to be able to restore any semblance of a working class that could support the revitalization of any major city or any area of this United States?
That's an absolute excellent question. I mean, that's the question. Like, I figure we, as 21st century citizens, we have two questions to solve, at least here in America, right? So the first question is, what do we do with our cities? And embedded in that is the idea of how we deal with the deindustrialization of America and the fact that all those jobs that used to give people benefits and give them the
wage,
ability to,
just simply a decent,
yeah, and a decent wage. All those jobs are gone. The second question is the issue of climate change. For me, I think the solution is political activism. Right, that's the real, and what I'm talking about is all types of acts, from as simple as saying, okay, the public good matters. Let's define the public good in terms of what our citizens need, our poor citizens, our destitute citizens, what they need to live healthy lives, and to sublimate the market to that. That is to say, instead of us shaping our politics for the market, we need to realize that the market is a political construction that needs to work for us. So even that small rhetorical shift, for those of us who are in the public arena like me, for those of us who are running for office, that rhetorical shift is part of it. But the other part of it is fighting and organizing from means traditional, that is electing people, you know, running campaigns, et cetera, to non-traditional. Here I'm referring to protests, boycotts, and things that people in places outside the United States are doing, but we haven't taken up, right? So it's political organizing. I actually believe that there is a way to take that second question, that is global climate change, and to use that issue to deal with the first thing, that is to provide the people the types of jobs that provide decent wages and benefits without necessarily needing, you know, high levels of degree. But some people disagree with me. Some economists, I think, have run numbers and say that it's kind of not possible to go back. But I actually think that as daunting as climate change is, it's going to require us to rebuild our entire infrastructure and way of life. And I think that task is far larger than the task we had at World War II. And without World War II, we don't even have that 50s and 60s moment where it's possible in Detroit for somebody to get fired at a plant with a high school degree and be black and then walk right across the street and get another job the same day. That actually happened to an older friend of mine.
Well, that's so exactly. I mean, that's a conversation I had with an older gentleman in our area, Bridgeport, Connecticut, which was the manufacturing hub of the Northeast. It was a joke. Get fired in the morning, find a job in the afternoon.
That's it.
To the extent that reconstruction of our infrastructure, which has been deteriorating for 40 years, could easily bring back a lot of these areas. But the political will, who's going to push this along? Who's going to have the vision that it's going to take 20 years to turn this around?
One way to think about this is, instead of thinking about what we need to do nationally, right? I'll just use my civil rights movement chops to kind of walk us through this. So blacks in the were in the 50s, in the 40s and 50s, no hell, in the 20s and 30s, were faced with a dynamic where at least half a segment of the country was basically a terrorist state, right?
Yeah.
It was a terrorist state, and they had to figure out, okay, how do we deal with this? Now, you did have people speaking about it nationally, but at a local level, like, wow, how do I deal with this neighborhood I'm in? And when you think about what happened with that bus boycott, what Rosa Parks and them did with that bus boycott, they weren't looking to dismantle Jim Crow. What they were looking to do was change the way political resources were allocated in one specific space, right? And
sure.
Then they were able to lash that up gradually against with other similar efforts, and they were also able to provide a template for similar efforts to happen across the country. And then that lashing up generally end up creating a national movement, right? So there's a work that I've been talking to a guy named Gar Alperovitz. I've had a conversation with him. We were on a book panel together in Baltimore. He wrote a book called What Then Must We Do? And that book, along with another one he's authored, talks about ways that people in cities like Cleveland and cities like Detroit are generating other ways to operate their economy at a local level. So whatever we do, it has to start locally and then build itself up. At worst, we don't win, but we provide templates that other people can use and lash onto and create something when the political climate's more favorable.
Thank you, Tom. We have Jay from New York. You're on the air with Dr. Lester K. Spence.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I would just like to take offense with one thing and then point out what I think the real issue is. I personally think that Kwame Kilpatrick was nothing more than a puppet for the powers that be that dealt with everything that happened in Detroit. I think that he may have signed a deal that happened with the banks that put them in this position. But there was a lot of people who was pulling his strings and put that deal into place. I think the most important thing that we must look at in regards to Detroit is the ramifications of what's going to happen with the pensions. Because once they're able to restructure these pensions by taking away, let's say, maybe 70 to 80% of them, that's just going to set the precedent for that happening in all major cities around the United States. So I think we need to be more concerned about that than anything. I mean, personally, Kwame Kilpatrick is irrelevant. I think he's been mistreated in a lot of ways, and I don't think he deserves the amount of time that he got in jail. He deserves some jail time, but 30-some years? Come on, let's be real.
Brother,
two things.
One is, I want you to stay on the line, because I know I don't have a lot of time, but I want to have this dialogue back with you. And then second, quick question, are you from the city? Are you in the city now?
No, I'm not from the city, but I have a lot of friends that are there.
Okay. Okay, so that's cool. I was just curious. So on Kwame Q, I think I agree with the substance of what you said, particularly the pensions, right? I think you're absolutely right. So I'm not going to tackle that because you're absolutely right. But on Kwame Kilpatrick, and this is where the black politics thing comes into play, I'd say two things. One is that you're I don't think that Kwame was a puppet. Kwame made choices, right? Kwame made choices. Now, the thing is his predecessor, Dennis Archer Jr., he probably would have made the same choices about that specific deal that Kwame made. Coleman Young probably would have made the same decisions on that deal that Kwame made, probably. Again, the only people who were probably pushing who were saying this deal was a bad deal were people on the left, right? So to that extent, I don't think that that's him being a puppet, but that's him kind of drinking the Kool-Aid, right? That's one thing. But the thing I disagree with strongly, although not emotionally, is about Kwame's time. So people in the city or people who support Kwame make two arguments. One argument is that people who've been jacking Detroit over, working for Bank of America, who jacked the nation over, that they haven't been sent to jail for this, and they're right on that. And then they argue similarly that there are examples of white politicians who've done things, not necessarily similar things, who've done things, and that they haven't gotten charged like Kwame has. And then finally, along the same lines, they've said, well, Kwame didn't kill anybody, right? So what I say is that we in cities like Detroit, Kwame comes from three different institutions that were designed to build black people and to increase black people's capacity to govern and to increase black people's capacity to provide for itself as for themselves as a community. The first is the Shrine of the Black Madonna, which is a black nationalist church that operates in Houston, Atlanta, and Detroit. The second is FAMU, which is a black college in Florida. And the third is Alpha Phi Alpha, the first black college fraternity in this country. Kwame Kilpatrick knew better. So when it comes time to him actually serving that time, he deserves every single year he gets because he's a public official who not just violated the public's trust, he violated, in this case, the black public trust. He violated the black public trust. I don't know why we would give him leniency in that. Now, one argument could be, and I'll give you just a minute. One argument could be that he should serve just a little bit of time, and then after he gets out, he should pay back the community. The thing that separates a murderer from Kwame Kilpatrick and other white-collar criminals is that we know that murder ages out, that if you commit a murder at 20, if we let you out at 31, 32, the odds are you're not going to commit that type of crime again because violent crime is age specific. White collar crime, you can commit from the time you engage in it until past retirement. So the one thing that Kwame would actually have the capacity to do as far as paying back the city would be to do foundation work, be to do nonprofit development. But he's a white-collar criminal. There's nothing that suggests that he has the capacity to actually realize what he did was wrong. If he got out, he would do the same thing again. So for that, I believe I'm sorry that Kwame's serving the time. He is a good brother, but he deserves that time he gets.
Well thank you,
well,
Jay.
All I can say is I totally agree with that analysis because, remember, who were the people who brung the deal to Kwame? They wasn't black faces. They were white faces who brung the deal to Kwame. It may have been black faces that signed off of it, a.k.a. Kwame and some of the other members, but look at it, just like what's going on with the manager now. It's the governor who's white, who got a black person in there doing all the dirt, and black people and other poor people of different colors and natural realities are suffering. And also, you mentioned about his association with sororities. Bro, let me tell you this about fraternities.
You know, you'll have to wrap up pretty fast, though, Jay, because we're running short on time.
Do me a favor, brother. I will come back on the show. My name is Lester Spaces. Look me up. Just holler at me.
You there, Jay? Okay. Well, Lester, I guess that means we have to reschedule you, and we go a bit deeper than today. But today was excellent. You gave us a very good, comprehensive overview, and you brought to our attention this business of the neoliberal turn, and that is an essential element in understanding what is happening in Detroit today. I want to thank you so much for being with us and for being so lively too. So I'll call you back and we'll arrange your return.
I'm with that. And real quick, all my people in Detroit listening, I'll be there in a couple of weeks. It's on and popping.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to Lead Stories today. You want to stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You can certainly write me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Take care. We see each other tomorrow right here at the same time, 1 o'clock. Take care.